Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Assalamu alaikum, and welcome to A Time for Justice. The Elevated Places Network presents A Time for Justice, and this show discusses legal and current events in a roundtable discussion with legal minds. We discuss this country's centuries-long failure to apply, uphold, and enforce the laws and the overall failure of the legal system to give justice and the negative impacts these failures have had on Black people and their Black families. Ultimately, we want fair dealing. We want justice under the law. But all too often, this is not the actions that we see. My name is Sister Pamela Muhammad, and I am an attorney in Houston, Texas, and I am so thankful to be the host of tonight's show because we have a really great show for you tonight. And again, this show, our guests, we don't make excuses for sometimes what we see as racist conduct, sometimes what we see is unfair conduct, just real injustices that we are seeking to make better. And so let's talk about just, fair, and equitable solutions, which are in the best interest of the people. And so tonight we have a very interesting topic because we're going to have an interview with our sister, Sherelle Muhammad. And Sister Sherelle Muhammad is a youth advocate, and she's the president of an organization called Juvenile Justice Advocates at Howard University. So this is going to be very interesting as we talk to our youth, our young people, the people who are training to be the leaders both tomorrow as well as assuming those leadership roles today. So I'm very thankful, and I would like to encourage everyone, as we talk to Sister Sherelle, get in the host queue, let's give some comments, let's give some feedback, but this sister is very dynamic, and she has a lot to say. Again, today, we'll be talking about juvenile justice advocates, and the thing about this is that we're talking about mentoring Black youth in this critical hour. I'm taking that from a topic that was the January 26, 2021 title of an article in The Final Call. And it just really talks about how in these times, try the human soul, the important African proverb that it takes a village to raise a child, takes on a whole new sense of urgency and a call to action in meeting the immense needs of Black youth and young adults. So we are here to support our sister and actually learn from this sister as she talks to us about her work in, as a juvenile justice advocate. So I'm going to open up her line. Want to go ahead and open up her line. But I also do want to give a short introduction. Sister Sherelle Muhammad is a psychology major and criminology minor from Howard University. Assalamu alaikum, Sister Sherelle. I got your line open.
Well, like as salam, ma'am. I'm here.
Yes, ma'am. So I'm going to go ahead and finish. So Sister Sherelle is a senior from Chicago, Illinois, and she is in the class of 2022. That's the graduating class of 2022. And as Sister Sherelle says, she is honored to serve as the president of Juvenile Justice Advocates of Howard University. Her future plans are to get her law degree from Howard University Law School and eventually open up her very own college. Now, this is amazing, amazing to me. So as we bring on Sister Sherelle, I wanted her to know that she's really helped me tonight. And we have some other attorneys that will be calling in because our show is a legal show and we like to talk to lawyers as well. But I think we've got to look at our youth and their knowledge because they're getting this cutting-edge, up-to-date information. And so she's going to take us through a journey with what youth law looks like and what some of the things that she's seen. So without further ado, Sister Sherelle, assalamu alaikum.
Well, like assalam. So I'll tell you a little bit about myself. So my name is Sherelle Muhammad. I'm the daughter of national spokesperson, Sister Dr. Ava Muhammad, and retired MBA star Brother Darius Muhammad. I'm a psychology major and a criminology minor from Howard University, and I will be attending law school next August, and my plans after school is to eventually open up the first HBCU. And I got an interest with youth through going on symposiums with my mom and our separation tour. And also I became a juvenile justice tutor about last year in January, and that just gave me also like an interest in the youth, just seeing them and working with them and tutoring them.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you so much for that. And like I wanted to say, we are honored that you would take your time to join us on this platform because I know school is just starting and you have so much to do. And we're so very proud of you as we are all of the nation's youth, all of our black youth. And so thank you again for joining us, sister. And so you're the president this year of an organization called Juvenile Justice Advocates. So tell us a little bit about the organization and what are the aims of this organization.
Yes, ma'am. Juvenile Justice Advocates provides tutoring and mentoring services to juveniles who are incarcerated at the D.C. Youth Detention Center. We give the youth guidance and direction, and we are oriented around social justice. We have a program title and model. It's called One Decision Away from Change. We understand that any of us can and could make the wrong decision and change our lives. We also understand that the residents that we work with are one decision away from change. We want to help them make better decisions to change their lives. We offer guidance and direction, and our goal is to try and make a change in the youth and show them all the positive things that the world has to offer. Our program has four interactive fun sessions upon the previous to help scholars make better decisions. We end with a closing ceremony that gives each participant a certificate that they can add to their folder and show a judge, their social worker, their family, and their friends. The certificate is signed by Dr. Bernard Richardson, Dean of the Chapel. And in order to be juvenile justice advocates, everyone on campus has to register and attend a training by celebrity professor, Dr. Bahia Muhammad, and no one can work in the detention center without proper training. And that's just one of the first steps to prepare to enter the facility.
Yes, ma'am. Let me ask you real quick.
Mm-hmm.
So you say one decision away from change. I think that's really excellent because you went on to say that any one of us could make the wrong decision. And so that's something that you all really emphasize. They can also make the right decision and change their lives. That's really great. Yes, ma'am.
Yes,
and
ma'am.
You say you offer them guidance and direction
and
to help them change their lives. Yeah, that's awesome.
Ma'am.
Yes, ma'am. So you were saying, I didn't want to stop you, but I just thought that was such an important thing to really focus on, that decision, one decision. Because we know sometimes that youth are impulsive. You know, adults are impulsive sometimes. So that ability to just kind of look at your decision-making before you do it, and that's what I really like. So go ahead. I just wanted to kind of interject there because you were going on to talk about the program and how you definitely have to be trained before you can even get into any of these facilities, right?
Yes, ma'am. So I was
going to continue on to say
We have a training at the Youth Detention Center to learn the rules and regulations for being a volunteer. And then by the time we enter the pod where the scholars are located, that's where we get started.
Okay. Now, when you say scholars, you mean the youth that are in these detention facilities. And you all
yes,
call
ma'am.
Them scholars,
the juveniles
right?
that want to learn. Yes,
that's
the juveniles
beautiful.
That want to learn.
Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
Go ahead.
And a Howard University, I just wanted to say, a Howard University student represents the product of a stable home environment and solid education. And even though many of our students have similar backgrounds to like the scholars that we are working with, some of us just made better decisions. And we want to show the youth like the other sides of themselves. And we want them to know like the power and possibility of who they are and who they can be. And we want to inspire and motivate them, and we want them to see from our experiences that there's always hope and that where they are, like, you don't have to stay there, and that's not where you have to be.
Yes, ma'am. That's beautiful. And, again, I think, you know, you're saying so much, and this issue about how Howard students, you have some that have come from stable environments and solid educations, but then, you know, and some of that is what you see in the juvenile system. But like you said, some of you all, you know, you're looking at making better decisions sometimes. And when we relate that to you, Sister Sherelle, you made some really great decisions early on with your educational pursuit. And I just kind of want to, you know, put that on you because you were really
– Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Because you kind of went through. You started early, community college. You went through. Is that how you did it? And then, you know, really – kind of really made the decisions to put you at Howard. And that's important. Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. So I think, again, thank you for that. And then you all went on to say that inspiring and motivating youth, because I think with the stereotypes, and we don't have to go into it, but with the stereotypes, you're letting them know that they have power and possibility of who they are. And some people would say, oh, black youth or brown youth or poor youth, you know, do we always see that type of attitude? So you feel like giving them that type of attitude gets good results. So, again, I'm kind of going through this with you because I think it's so important what you're sharing. So let me ask you this, because you got into this. And I'm sure, like you say, traveling with your mom and, you know, on the different tours, and that gives you so much insight. But tell us, why do you feel there is a need for juvenile advocacy at this time? What's going on? Why did you feel like you wanted to get into this and there's really this need? And can you share
ma'am.
With us? Okay.
Yes, ma'am. So juvenile advocacy is immensely in need because advocates for children are vitally important because children, they're not able to speak out efficiently for themselves. And being an advocate is acting to make your family, your community, and the nation or the world better for the children. Things that are supporting youth success and rehabilitation over the years are advocates and people that take care of them in proper ways. Things that contribute to the failure is a deteriorated family unit, I believe.
Okay.
And yes, ma'am. I feel like youth are being placed in adult jails, and that like that's contributing to their failure because like it puts them at greater risk for things like, you know, increased trauma, physical violence, and like sexual assault and suicide.
Yes, ma'am. Yeah, and I think, you know, what you said earlier about children, I think you said it, I know we talked about it, that children are not able to speak out effectively for themselves.
Yes, ma'am.
I think I opened up the mic. Brother Deshaun is an attorney that practices a lot of juvenile law. And Brother Deshaun, are you here?
Yes, ma'am. I'm here. Assalamu alaikum.
Walaikum salam, Brother Deshaun. And Brother Deshaun, this is Sister Sherelle, and we're having a conversation with her. And Brother Deshaun and I were so excited when we thought about you coming on, Sister Sherelle, because I started practicing law like 30 years ago, started kind of doing the juvenile law. And I learned so much that I did not know coming from my stable family, stable home, or whatever. And so when I got to see the youth in the system, you know, it's like a head scratcher. It was so many, just adventures and just so many. I learned so much. And so to hear you and see you at such an early age becoming a scholar on this is important. But this issue about children not being able to speak out effectively for themselves and needing advocates, I just think that's so important because these are babies who are being put into detention and being penalized, and they're black. So, Brother Deshaun, did you want to, you know, that's something that you saw, too, her point about children not being able to speak effectively for themselves.
I think what you're doing is awesome because it's someone closer in age to them, and you're talking about mentoring, they're more likely to listen to you because, like you said, many of the students come from similar backgrounds than they do. So there's not that separation to say, you haven't been through what I've been through.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the students that you deal with that you're bringing into the jail have been through exactly what they've been through. And I found that even in my practice, my upbringing helps me a lot with the juveniles that I deal with, in that even though my household was stable, where I grew up in Chicago usually gives me the credibility to discuss whatever with my clients. And a mentor is so needed in these cases. An advocate who, like you said, has the backing of the school, you can say something on behalf of these children and actually be listened to. Whereas if they said it themselves, nobody really cares. So I think what you're doing is really beautiful. I don't understand all the nuance of your program, but I think just the willingness for a college student to step up and try to help our youth in these circumstances is beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah, I agree. And Sister Ro, we'll let you continue. But I just want the audience to understand that in juvenile justice, in juvenile law, the fact that these are babies, and you would think that people don't mistreat children, that's what we've always been taught. But these children don't have the ability sometimes to speak up for themselves, and herein lies part of the problem. So I just kind of wanted to interject that, Sister Sherelle, because you're doing such a great job. But, you know, if you can continue, what you were saying. Mm-hmm.
Yes, ma'am. So I was going to give a little bit of statistics. So the U.S. is the only country in the world where kids as young as 13 have been sentenced to life imprisonment without the possibility of parole. Before the Supreme Court banned the death penalty for juveniles in 2005, 366 people were executed for juvenile offenses. The ban allowed EJI to focus on some 3,000 people who were sentenced to the life imprisonment without parole for offenses committed when they were 17 or younger. Children as young as 13 were among those condemned to die in prison. Most and more youth are getting locked up daily, also because the politicians are not caring, and they have no budget for them.
They have a budget to open up the facilities, but they don't have a budget to give juveniles all the proper resources that they need. When Biden was running for president, he promised and pledged to make juvenile justice a priority, including the new payments of around $1 billion per year. We have yet to see it and most likely won't ever see it. Juveniles
wow.
are also faced, yes, ma'am. Juveniles are also faced with dealing with super predators, prejudice, and biases. Every state charges juvenile justice costs, fees, fines, and restitution. Youth who can't afford to pay for their freedom often face serious consequences, including incarceration, extended probation, or denial of treatment. They are unfairly penalized for being poor and pulled deeper into the justice system. The view of the youth of color, yes, the view of the youth of color as different and deserving as harsher treatments was intensified in the 1980s with the perpetrator of the super predator myth. A super predator is basically like, yes, ma'am. A super predator is basically when they have like when they say like there's a new breed of brutal youth, commonly viewed as youth of color, we're going to terrorize the country, and all these negative forces are being thrown at juveniles, and it's like they're being torn down in every way possible.
Wow, yes, ma'am. And again, you said so much there, Sister Sherelle. So for you at this age and in the space that you're in and know these things, such as politicians, you know, juvenile, and brother Deshaun, I know you weigh in, because you're talking about bunch of failed promises. You know, when it comes to monitoring them in these detention centers, they had all kinds of things in place that were supposed to be safeguards, but none of that happened. You know, Sister Sherelle, she talked about the super predators, and you know, you, I don't even know if you were born then, Sister Sherelle, but the time when all that negative, you know, publicity and lying on youth, can you, I mean, just in looking at that, do you see how evil and wicked that was? You said here that they were some new breed of brutal youth, and none of that was even true.
It wasn't.
Isn't that is so horrible. So, yeah, That's something. Yes, sir, Brother Deshaun.
I was going to ask, what has been her experience in actually when she goes out to these facilities, and what has she actually seen?
So go ahead. You can finish.
Yeah. What's been your experience? How have you been able to interact with the students?
Yes, so due to COVID, we wasn't able to go into the facilities last year. So we're just starting this week, actually. So we go tomorrow, Wednesday, and it's from 5 to 10. First, we have to have the training, and then we can go into the pods. But it's only going to be 5 at a time since COVID.
Mm-hmm.
And everything. It's only be 5 people at a time. So my first day going into the facilities will be tomorrow at 5 p.m.
Okay.
I can tell you that most likely what you'll be greeted with is surprise that someone young is actually showing up. Someone young and black is showing up to offer them something and to talk to them. And
that's
not
a good point.
Just showing up to tell them what they need to do. So I think this is really beautiful, because you can show them that it's possible. So many of my clients don't even believe it's possible to move any other way.
Yes, I definitely can't wait. I'm interested to see.
And so for the listeners, we're interviewing Sister Sherelle Muhammad, and she is a youth advocate and president of the Juvenile Justice Advocates at Howard University. And one of the things you said, Sister Sherelle, just we want to make sure the audience heard that as well, was this thing about fines and fees and costs and all of these things that are assessed against children who, as you say, they're unfairly penalized for being poor. And you said this pulls them, deeper into the justice system. That's what I heard you say. Yes, ma'am. So, Yeah, so going on, we had some questions, and again, if anybody has any comments or questions they want to pose, please get into the host queue as we had this wonderful conversation, kind of a juvenile justice 101, but it's going from the new mind of these youth who understand and have the spiritual component to work our babies. So, you know, let's again thank this sister for taking the time to talk to her, because we see this term so often, Sister Sherelle, the term advocate. And what is an advocate? What is an advocate?
An advocate is basically defined to speak, write, or stand up for something or someone. Advocacy is also about helping people find their voice. There's three types of advocacy. It's self-advocacy, individual advocacy, and systems advocacy. Basically, becoming a juvenile advocate is important to make a difference in children issues and get involved. Things do not happen on their own. We have to take action. Children need us to, yes, ma'am. Children need us to look out for them and their well-being. Not only does this help children out, but you feel good knowing that you can make a difference just for children and that you can change a child's life. Advocacy is powerful, and it's an important catalyst for the change we want to see. And we can work together to improve the laws, policies, and systems that affect the communities that we serve.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's beautiful. That's kind of what Brother Deshaun was saying. Go ahead, Brother Deshaun. I'm sorry.
Oh, no problem. As the sister was talking, one of the things I thought about, all the things about changing the outside are beautiful, but the part that stands out the most to me about what you're doing is you mentioned the whole idea of super predators. And I can tell you from being in the courtroom, I often deal with people who view our children as just that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not just the court system that views our children that way. Sometimes it's their
stereotype.
And oftentimes it's the child themselves. And that's why I'm so impressed with, because having somebody who's been through a similar background to talk to these children, they think they're super predators. They think this is all they're capable of, some of them. And so showing them that it's possible, that you are not meant to do this, and this is not who you're supposed to be, is huge.
Yeah.
Because when they put out that myth, they didn't just convince white people. They convinced us about our own community. You know, I often deal with, you know, elders from our own community who feel that way about certain children. And their parents may feel that way about them. They're just irredeemable, meant to be bad. But I've seen some of those same people turn around. So it's not impossible. And just having someone to talk to them and tell them that, you know, not only is this possible, which I'm sure they've heard before, but to be able to say, I've walked a road like you.
Right.
And I'm doing something else. That means something.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And I'm so excited. Look, Sister Sherelle, we're so excited to have you to talk to. And we do have some people in the host queue that want to make some comments. But I do want to say this real fast. You know what? When I first started, you know, believe it or not, a lot of the people that volunteered to go into facilities were white people. And so you didn't have as many black people doing it. So that's another, I think, added factor. I mean, you're in a black city such as D.C. where there's, you know, large black populations. But as our people, as Brother Deshaun are realizing the need to help, it's just wonderful. So we're going to take a question, if you don't mind, Sister Rel. Can we take a question, a couple questions or comments?
Yes, ma'am, of course.
Okay, so we have Sister Donna.
Assalamu alaikum, Sister Donna.
Well, alaikum shalom, Sister Sherelle. Attorney Pamela and Attorney Deshaun, this is such a wonderful program. I'm really excited about it.
Praise the
one, because it's a young person.
That's right. That's right.
That's easy. So I just had two quick questions, if I may. The first one, you mentioned in your introduction about being shaped by going to events and symposiums and separation town halls with your parents. I wanted to know if in those journeys maybe you saw something specific that moved you down this path that you're on. And then it also mentioned about, I believe, you wanted to open a college.
Yes,
and I wanted to, you know, get into why and what would be different.
Yes, ma'am. So I would say the thing that touched me was my, like, seeing my mom interact with people. And it was like just something about her spirit was just touching people. I would see people cry. I would see people change their life around. Like, I would see people want to join the nation. Like, I would just see all type of stuff. And it just showed me, like, I wanted to be just like that. Like, I wanted to be able to do that. And I want to be just like her. So that's what made me do that for the first question. And for the second question, I just started going to Howard, and I just was like, I don't like this. Like, I don't like, even though Howard is a HBCU, it's not owned by a black person. It's owned by Oliver Howard. It's owned by, Oliver Howard, that's his name. And he's a white man. And just basically, like, I just wanted to be that person, like, to be ashamed, to be able to have, you know, our own Muhammad University, like a university, you know, like, be able to, and then I also, being on the symposiums with my mom, I started making a blueprint. I think I was like probably like 15. I made a blueprint like of a university, and then coming to Howard, I was just like, that's what I'm here. I didn't get here for no reason. It's no coincidence. I don't believe in coincidences. Like, I'm here to do that, and I just have to keep going, and whatever it takes, just do it, because we have to have our own. We have to separate. We have to have our own educational system, because we just have to, in order to get higher, education brings us higher. So that's why.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Yeah, beautiful. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for that, Sister Donna. Let's see. We have another question or comment. Let's see. Let me open up the mic for Sister Marguerite.
Assalamualaikum, yes, Marguerite. It is so wonderful. I love listening to old people and the youth. They're just,
yes,
it's,
ma'am,
just something that comes out of them that is just so wise. And just, I'm so glad you are doing what you're doing. All praises due to Allah for your generation. Mm-hmm. It's going to be,
yes,
one,
ma'am,
to deal with. One of the things that I had meant to mention, and it's, you know, it's coming up again in your show, was really the term the super predator, and where that came from. And we can thank Hillary Clinton, of course, for jacketing,
right,
our youth with that term. But
mm-hmm,
I was reading, you know, if you've heard of Michelle Alexander, who did the new Jim Crow, she also did a article about why black people should not vote for Hillary Clinton. And she just lined out all the things that Hillary Clinton had done, you know, behind the door with her Republican comrades against black people. Now,
yes,
one of the things that term comes from, they had a study back in the 70s, 80s on the double Y chromosome. They found that most serial killers had a double Y chromosome. So they went into studying that, and they came to find out, it, you know, they were violent on top of that. So that showed them that white men were the only ones that they could find that had that double Y chromosome. So now all of a sudden, you know, this is their super predator label, but all of a sudden it gets morphed and put on black youth. When the study shows it is white males who are actually the super predators. So they know when they're lying through their teeth. You know, as they say, how do you know when a politician's lying? When their lips is moving. And he stood there blatantly and lied and labeled our children that, and they have been burdened under that ever since. thanks to Hillary Clinton. And the article is specifically why black people should not vote for Hillary Clinton. And it was on the net, unless it's been scrubbed, but it is worth reading to really understand and throw off this, because it doesn't fit us at all. It doesn't fit our children at all.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you, Sister Marguerite. I think that's so important, even as we look today, where you have these stereotypes that are thrown out, and then the media gets around it, and then you see all these news shows that are saying it, and they even have made-up TV shows, dramas that, you know, these characters are like this. The Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, you know, would tell us about, like, Minister Society and, you know, the different movies that were out during the time. So it was a very difficult time, Sister Sherelle, to live in. And again, I thank you for your wisdom, because one of the things you said were that all these negative forces are thrown at the juveniles, and they are being torn down in every way possible. I think that's something that the audience really needs to remember, that you said that. So I'm going to go to the next question. Are many of the youth in the system black? You know, and yes, ma'am, are many of the youth black?
Yes, ma'am. So black youth make up almost half of the juvenile population. About 41% of youth in placements of facilities are black. African-American youth are at least 10 times as likely to be held in placements as white youth in the detention centers.
That's interesting. But we only make up the smaller part of the population, but 10 times as likely to be held. So in placement, you know, and so going on, I think this is a very important topic. So children, and everybody's kind of touched on it with the mislaid labeling and the stereotype, but, you know, are the children, you know, just bad? I mean, because we can take some responsibility, but I know we're not just bad, you know. So what's going on that you see that's getting them caught up in the system?
So one problem contributing to the issue is that the justice system focuses mainly on punishing the juvenile offenders through prison time instead of taking the preventative measures and support and rehabilitation. The average annual cost of housing one juvenile in jail is $88,000. That number multiplied by the number of incarcerated juveniles equates to an end cost to the government of approximately $21 billion. Factors such as environmental, psychological, and social aspects are all possible contributing parts of the problem. One of the most prevalent reasons are socially related factors. These include family relationships, peer pressure, and gangs. Oftentimes, the combination of hormonal changes and a bad family life are a good mix for trouble with the juvenile. If a child grows up in a home with poor parental management, poor supervision, inconsistent discipline, they are at a greater chance of being involved in illegal activities. As poverty increases for a family, so does the rate of incarceration. An estimated 50 to 75% of juveniles who are incarcerated become incarcerated again.
Wow. I mean, she says so much, y'all, in that, you know, she's talking about 50 to 75% of juveniles who are incarcerated become later incarcerated again. That's about recidivism. That's about, is the system not really working? She's touching on how poor parental management and supervision, you know, we're at fault. And those of us in the community who have some stability need to look at that in terms of helping those who may not have those abilities. But I think one of the biggest things she said that it took me years to realize is how much money is being spent. And these dollars are on our children's head. Because if there's $88,000, the annual cost of housing a juvenile, that's money that somebody is making. You know,
yeah,
go ahead, Brother Deshaun. Yes, sir.
I'm sorry. It's not just that it's a profit.
That's right.
Yes.
So many people are profiting off our youth. you know, the fact that the government is spending it, but the government is spending it on chosen contractors and so forth. So it's a great way for the government to just basically hand money to chosen individuals. And in general, those who they give the money to aren't, just like you said, basically holding children as opposed to rehabilitating them. There are very few programs to rehabilitate the children and so many to essentially continue the system.
Right. All that money could be used to better the youth instead of tearing them down.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yes. Fraction of the money, you know. Go ahead.
Yeah. And I also got a comment from somebody watching the show. They said Howard University was founded by Oliver Howard, who was a general in Civil War, but he murdered a tribe of Native American, mostly women and children, because they refused to move on a reservation.
Wow.
Howard University. That's who Howard University was founded by. Right.
Wow, thank you for that. That's interesting. I mean, you know, our youth, you all, we're celebrating the fact that we have young people that are getting this wisdom and they have so much more knowledge to put with this academic wisdom and going out. I saw, like, one of the seminars that was done, and I was so impressed by the young women who are just seriously looking at these issues at such an early age. So with that, let's talk about some of the stats and some of the demographics, you know, that you think the audience needs to know about youth and what's going on in these hearings. Go, yes, ma'am.
Yes, ma'am. Okay, so I have a lot of stats. So
okay.
I'll go through them real quick. Okay. So during a single year, an estimated 2.1 million youth under the age of 18 are arrested in the United States. Though overall rates have been declining over the past years, approximately 1.7 million delinquency cases are disposed of in juvenile courts annually. Approximately 57% of educated youth are placed on probation. Approximately 86,900 youth under the age of 21 are detained or confined in public and private detention centers, group homes, camps, ranches, and other correctional institutions. The average cost per youth is $240.99 per day based on the state-funded post-education residential facilities in which 70% of educated youth reside. Youth who are detained or incarcerated may be subject to various negative circumstances, including overcrowding, physical and sexual violence, trauma, risk of suicide, and death. Data continues to suggest that girls are less likely to be detained and committed than boys for most categories of delinquent offenses. Minority youth are most likely. Yes, ma'am. Did you have a comment?
Well, I wanted to say this real fast because you're giving so much information. And when you start, you're talking about the negative circumstances that our youth are experiencing while being detained, the overcrowding, the sexual violence, you know, the risk of suicide and death. And then we look and we wonder why the youth are angry. You know, I can remember when I first started practicing back here, back at some point, they had some camps because, like Brother Deshaun said, people get these contracts. And they had a camp called a wilderness camp. These were wilderness concepts where they were taking the youth, you know, some into the wilderness. But, you know, this particular one that hit the news, it showed that they really, it wasn't even something you would let your, you know, it was very inhumane. Let me put it that way. And so when you talk about, you said the $240 per day, And the fact they are subjected to these negative consequences. I mean, this is real. This is so real.
Yeah.
So I'm thanking you for bringing this to us. And again, real quick, anybody that has a question or a comment, please press the number 1 to get into the host queue. And Sister Sherelle Muhammad, Howard University President of the Juvenile Justice Advocates, is sharing her information with us today, her knowledge. Okay, yes, ma'am.
Yes, ma'am. So minority youth are more likely to be detained and committed than non-Hispanic whites. African American youth have the highest rates of involvement compared to other racial groups. They make up 16% of all youth in the general population, but 30% of the juvenile court referrals, 38% of the youth in residential placement, and 58% of the youth admitted to state adult prison. Based on studies of juveniles released from state incarceration, rearrest rates were substantially higher than other measures of recidivism. Across studies with a 12-month follow-up period, the average rate of rearrest for delinquent or criminal offenses was 55%. The average reconviction or re-education rate was 33%, and the average reincarceration and reconfinement rate was 24%. Nearly half of all students who enter residential juvenile justice facilities have an academic achievement level that is below the grade equivalent for their age. Many incarcerated youth are marginally literate or illiterate and have already experienced school failure. Youth in the juvenile justice system are identified as eligible for special education services at 3 to 7 times the rate of youth outside the system. When a student is suspended or expelled, there is a significant increase in his or her likelihood of being involved in the juvenile justice system the subsequent year. Many youth who are incarcerated have a history of truancy and grade retention. A study more than 400 incarcerated ninth graders found that in the year prior to the incarceration, these students had attended school barely half the time and were failing most of their courses.
Mm.
Yes, ma'am. A large number of youth in the juvenile justice system have a history of trauma, emotional, and behavioral problems. A high percentage of youth, 65 to 70% involved with the juvenile justice system, have a diagnosable mental health disorder, and nearly 30% of those experience severe mental health disorders. Most youth in the system meet the criteria for or are diagnosed with more than one mental health disorder. Youth in contact with the juvenile justice system experience higher prevalence rates across various types of mental health disorders, disruptive disorders such as conduct disorders and substance use disorders, and most commonly 46.5%, followed by anxiety disorders by 33.4%, and mood disorders followed by 18.3%, such as depression. A majority of court-involved adolescents have recently used illegal substance. The more serious and chronic adolescent offenders have been found to use more substances and are more likely to qualify for a diagnosis of a substance use disorder. Higher levels of substance use increases the rate of offending, the severity of the committed offense, and the duration of the antisocial behavior. While juvenile arrests for the most offense were declined between 1994 and 2003, the rate of arrest of drug abuse violations increased. The increase was far greater among females than males.
Yes, ma'am. And you know, so again, she said a lot, and the question that she was responding to, you know, was the question about what's really going on. You know, what is behind them, you know, appearing in these situations. And, you know, she talked about the literacy issue and how if you're not literate, if they're not getting the proper education, then, you know, what do we see? The truancy, why are they not coming to school? Maybe because it's not, they don't see themselves as we've been taught. But I think the drug use, Sister Sherelle, is one that is really worth looking at because,
yeah,
Brother Deshaun, as you and I both remember, maybe more than you, you know, I witnessed the manufacturing of some of these disorders that have now become so common. And with those disorders was the psychotropic medicine being given at very high rates. And so when you're given like 3-year-olds and 5-year-olds and 7-year-olds psychotropic meds, because maybe you're saying they got some behavioral issue, then does that set up possibly some of this drug addiction and the need for drugs, not to mention what we're seeing in the streets where drugs have just been flooding the streets.
Right.
So, yeah, yeah.
Yes, ma'am. I think you're really hitting some really good points. And again, if anyone has a comment or a question that they would like, please.
I'm sorry. I think I was on.
Yes, sir. Go ahead, Brother Deshaun.
I think I was muted. I was trying to chime in on exactly what you were saying, which is when I started practicing, I was told that, you know, psychologists and psychiatrists are really, really, they find it very difficult to diagnose somebody under the age of, like, you know, say 14 or so with any type of mental disorder because the mind is still growing and so forth. That was when I started practicing. But in the many years since then, I find exactly what you said, which is many children who are very young, they, the first thing they'll diagnose them with is ADHD. They just progress from there and continue to give them, you know, stronger diagnoses. But when they diagnose them with ADHD, they start drugging them. So I don't know if, A, usually the original diagnosis is wrong, but once you start giving a child psychotropic meds, we have no idea what you've done to them and caused from that point on. So, it, you know, we a lot of damage is done to our children early on with these diagnoses. And I think some of the parents really need to try and get a second opinion when their child is diagnosed with this. But as the sister was talking, the thing that stuck in my head was the minister talking about the purpose of education. And I think what she's doing is so, so important because we have to, our youth have to see exactly what the sister, what, I'm sorry, sister, I forget your name. Please forgive me.
Sister Sherelle. Yes, sir.
Sister Sherelle.
And I think many of our youth need to see exactly what you see, which is that the education that you're getting, you can take that and change your community and do massive things, but do them for our community. And if more of us saw what you see, we could turn these things around. Because I'm sure when you start the university that you want to start, the focus will be on changing the lives of our people. And, you know, making the focus on doing something for self as opposed to taking all these skills that we have away. Because we would have mentors if we stayed in the community once we have this education. It's all tied together. We always say that one of the big problems with juvenile injustice is the school system. But we have to change the mindset about why we're being educated, because we can fix it from the top down as well as from the bottom up.
Yes, sir. We're going to take this caller. Our next caller is Sister Dr. Ava Muhammad. Sister Dr. Ava Muhammad. Assalamu alaikum, ma'am.
Assalamu alaikum.
I'm really
enjoying the program. Thank you, Sister Attorney Pamela, Brother Attorney Deshaun, and Sister Sherelle Muhammad. When Sister Sherelle was delineating those statistics about the diagnosable mental health disorders, I thought about the current situation with COVID-19 and this all-out campaign to vaccinate the entire population, but now there is there's an intense campaign to get to children. And of course, they were able to get authorization to vaccinate 18 years old and under down to the age 12. Now the campaign is to get from age 12 to one day old, this vaccine. And it's already been demonstrated that the numerous vaccines that have been administered to our children over the last 35 years are really at the root of a lot of these behavioral issues and some of the conditions that our children suffer. And, you know, as Sister Sherelle is pointing out, many of our children actually qualify to be in special education, but they are handled as though they are just guilty of bad behavior, you know, which is an extension of this view of black people as being inherently criminal in our behavior. And the Million Man March actually arose out of Minister Farrakhan's concern with the image of the black man and particularly the black youth that has been communicated globally by the types of stereotypical images that are presented about us. And so I appreciate this program because you did an episode, Sister Pamela, a few weeks ago on taking our children back, about us as adults being too quick to allow our offspring to get caught up in this system, because as all of you are saying, you know, once we get in this system, now you have, I think the statistic was a 55% chance that you'll be back, and that's the recidivism, and that's the path into being in a correctional facility for the rest of one's life. So it's just a modern day form of slavery. But I just wanted to say how much I really appreciate this program and all of
all
you,
praises
all of
to
your
Allah.
Thank you.
All
praises to you.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. You made this possible. Thank you for your daughter. She's so intelligent on this. And we're so thankful for you as well, Sister Ava, with the Elevated Places Network feeding us. So, yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Thank you.
Praise. Yes, ma'am. Assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum.
Yes, ma'am. So, Sister Sherelle, I think we're going on to the next. Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. We're going on to the next point regarding, I think your mom kind of talked about it, about children in the system, and that, you know, somehow the recidivism and how they're just on modern-day slavery, we see they're not being treated as children because the juvenile system is unique, and it's supposed to treat children as children, not like many adults. But all too often, we wouldn't even know that as black people because the way our children are drugged through the mud by a system, you know, we would know that there's a difference in the way the juvenile system is supposed to work. So can you tell us about, I guess, some of the language and the laws for youth that make a difference in how children, you know, should be perceived and how they should be treated in the system? And I guess the failures that we see with black and brown youth sometimes.
Yes, ma'am. So the juvenile justice process involves 9 major decision points. The first one is arrest. The second one is referral to court. The third one is diversion. The fourth one is secure detention. The fifth is the judicial waiver to adult criminal court. The sixth is case petitioning. The seventh is delinquency finding and adjudication. The eighth is probation. And the ninth is residential placement, including confinement in a secure correctional facility. The majority of cases are first referred to the juvenile justice system through contact with police. Probation officers, school officials, or parents usually refer to the remaining cases. The most common offenses referred to court are property offenses, and that's about 92%. Followed by personal offenses, which is 89.5%. and drugs, which is 88%, and general delinquency charges, which is 81.6%. Other referrals come from schools, family, or social workers, or probation officers. There's a difference between detention versus arrest. While both involve interaction with the police, an arrest basically means that you're charged with a crime, and detention is merely a moment of questioning by the police. The judge can sentence someone to an adjudication of guilt, or the judge can withhold adjudication of guilt. If the judge adjudicates you guilty, it means you have been formally found guilty of the crime and you are convicted of the crime. Juvenile cases are similar to adult court proceedings. If he or she has been found guilty in juvenile court, the verdict is called adjudication. And adjudication does not always mean incarceration as it might in adult criminal court. The majority of the youth processed through the juvenile court are adjudicated and basically declared by a judge to be delinquent for most offenses.
Yes, ma'am. And I think what she's, you know, what she's saying in a lot of ways is in layman terms for us who, you know, we understand the high technology words, but youth are really in civil proceedings. It's not a criminal necessarily proceeding like in a criminal court. This is civil. And we're seeing these children, the whole thing is that they're in need of supervision. That's really the whole key here. We're looking to see, is this child in need of supervision? Is there proper supervision? Because otherwise they wouldn't be out here. And so that's at the root of the detention, like she said. That's at the root of the adjudication, because it's very different than the criminal court system. But all too often that's not what happens with our children. So we got a couple other callers who have questions, Sister Sherelle, if you don't mind, if we could take a comment.
Yes, ma'am. Yes. I don't mind.
Okay. So Brother Thiel, another attorney, is on the line, and Brother Thiel, assalamu alaikum, sir.
Wa alaikum salam, and good evening, everyone. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. We hear you fine.
Yes, sir.
And Princess Sherelle, I'm so proud, my dear, to hear the wonderful work that you're doing up there in D.C. and part of the Howard University student body. That just to know that our young people are, you know, doing this, it just makes me feel proud that and secure that that our future is secure. Even our legal profession is secure. So I thank you so very much, Princess, for, you know, what you are doing. And I had a question or comment, it's sort of intertwined, or not to be confusing, but as Sister Pamela and Brother Deshaun and other attorneys would know, you know, we deal with sometimes experts, you know, when we have a trial or hearing or something like that. And what I'm really getting at then is, because, you know, the program that you and the university up there are involved with, is there any thought or hope that you all would partner with, let's say, attorneys who are representing young people, you know, in these juvenile hearings, let's say if they have to go to court or something like that, that you all would be partnering up with an attorney to provide the attorney some expert insight into the young people who are in front of these courts? In other words, is there a hope that or thought that the program or you yourself would be able to advocate and assist the attorneys representing these young people? And also, of course, as you become an attorney, is there any sort of, you know, hope that that sort of experience would be able to assist these young people in these court proceedings, if you understand what I'm asking?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. That's actually an amazing idea. We're definitely open to it, and I would love to do something like that, because a lot of the juveniles, they don't have proper attorneys. They have, like, attorneys that really don't care about them, and they have so many cases they can't even take time out their day to care about them. So I'm definitely open to it. I can give you my email if you want, is hujuvenilejustice87@gmail.com.
Okay,
and you
Princess,
can
you do me that if you would just be so kind, can you just do that? Tell me that one more time. I didn't have my pen ready. I apologize, dear.
Okay, so it is hujuvenilejustice67@gmail.com. hujuvenilejustice67@gmail.com.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you so much, ma'am.
Yes, sir.
Yeah,
thank
beautiful.
You. Thank you.
Yeah, and brother Athiel wanted to tell you that he has some experience living in the D.C. area. Isn't that correct, brother Athiel? As an attorney.
Yes. Not to give my own personal stuff, but yeah, I lived in D.C. for a number of years before it was time for me to realize my lifelong dream, you know, of becoming an attorney. So I'm quite familiar with the D.C. area and just, you know, thankful to Allah that we got the opportunity to realize our lifelong dream. But also, dear, I wanted to ask, you know, one more thing, if I may.
Sure.
May I, Sister Pamela? Thank you. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Dear,
what success stories have you, or what would you consider a success story of a young person who is in the program that, you know, that in the advocacy program, not from the Howard University standpoint, but from a young person who is, you know, in one of these facilities? What would you look at as a success story? Let's say that person coming out, would it be that young person is not part of the recidivism statistic?
I would say a lot of people, it's like a domino effect. So if you break the domino effect, they call it the generational curse. If you break that, like, you're the chosen one. That's how our generation sees it. But I would have to say a lot of people, they believe, like, their success stories come from their family being locked up, and they didn't go that same route. They made it out. And I would also say, yeah, I would basically say that.
That's beautiful. Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah, and Brother Thiel, I think if you heard at the beginning, too, she made the point about the decision-making, one decision at a time. So I think, you know, we
one decision
know
away from change.
One decision
and, you know,
away
it's
from
interesting.
Change. Thank you.
And it was interesting also that what I also heard you just say or allude to even, you know, during your presentation was that, you know, what it is that we see. You know, I remember, and I don't practice, I don't represent many young people. I have, you know, a few that I've represented, but one young man in particular a young man was accused of shoplifting. I think it was a baseball cap. And he was in the City of Houston Municipal Court, which would, of course, was just a low-level matter. But what I found was interesting was, and you let me know, Princess, if you've seen this in speaking or heard this in speaking with some of the young people at the facility that you all deal with, that this young man, I was representing him. The judge asked me to represent him. He appointed me right away to represent the young man, and we did, of course, you know. But I found it was interesting that he was there with his father, and mm-hmm. his father asked me for a business card, and lo and behold, his father had a court appearance for a felony charge, you know. Mm-hmm. And so what that alarmed me was that the young man, you know, is in the system for, you know, a baseball cap. I don't know, the $5 or $10 baseball cap, whatever the price was. But mm-hmm. his father, his role model, if you will, is also dealing with and in the criminal justice system with a felony charge. So my thing is, have you, you know, spoken with or in your speaking with these young people at this facility, is that part of what you see as well as, you know, the drugs, addiction and the truancy? Do you find also, or have you seen also that the young people have adults in their life or in their lives who have also, you know, involved in the criminal justice system, and that could unfortunately shape their decisions?
Yeah, and Brother, I'm going to interject real quick. She may not have seen it personally because what they do in those detention centers, you know how that goes. But I know you got the stats on it. So I'm sorry, Sister Sherelle, I wanted to, though.
I would say the juveniles are basically like they're all victims of not having a proper family unit. And I would have to say people like us that go into the detention centers, we have a proper family unit. That's why we want to help them. So I would say mostly all the juveniles, they don't come from like a good family. They come from like abuse, neglect, you know, things like that.
Yes,
Thank you. That's good. Yeah, that's so awesome. Because I know those stats you all had too, Sister Sherelle, they've talked about like so many of these young people have what Brother Thiel is saying, a parent or someone who's also been incarcerated, and those were the statistics. So it's going to be interesting as to what you all continue to see. And, again, we're just so thankful that you're sharing and that you're so willing to help the youth. And so I wanted to take this opportunity, actually, because we're down to 19 minutes, and I wanted to say to Brother Deshaun, really always, every time he takes the time to be on the show, I'm always so honored and thankful because I know he, as a black male attorney, Sister Sherelle, they're not as prevalent sometimes in the area of juvenile justice and family law and family matters. And so, you know, him as an FOI and as a brother, a black male, you know, I wanted to thank him once again for, you know, doing what he does in these courtrooms every day, working with our children and our youth, and also thank him much for taking his time to come on and spend this time, you know, on this topic, Sister Sherelle. It's so important. So you make sure you encourage some of your friends and your peers, and especially some of the young men that you see to look at this area, because it's a great area.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, ma'am.
Well,
I'm going to go on. Go ahead. Yes, sir.
I was going to say I appreciate what you said, but this is our mission. The minister said to feed our lambs, to help the youth. This is the key to the whole mission that we're trying to do, and that's what I'm trying to do, and that's why I'm really so proud of the sister, to see somebody who's actually on the precipice of coming out of college with a focus on helping our community. I keep repeating it, but it's so huge because it's so rare, and I know that many of the influences you have in school are trying to focus you on, you know, all the different corporate possibilities and so forth, and all the different types of law that you could do that would enrich you but not necessarily help the community. So anytime I see someone trying to give back, I mean, we all want our jobs to be easier. So, you know, the work that you're doing helps towards that, and that's all I'm trying to do. So praise be to Allah.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And Sister Sherelle, we have one more caller. Can I take the caller? I have a caller.
Of course.
Nyla. Sister Nyla. Yes, ma'am. Sister Nyla.
Assalamu alaikum.
Yes, this is my daughter, Sister Nyla.
Yes, hi, Mom. my name is Sister Nyla. I'm from Houston, Texas, and I am a senior at Wiley College. My major is education. And I just want to just kind of briefly add to what you guys were saying earlier with the ADHD and then just tying it into this new generation. Working with people that are younger than me, I'm 24, but working with people that are in their 20s and younger, or being around just people that are slightly younger than me, you see their ambition and their drive. And I think it's interesting how the – I feel like the younger the generations get, this quote-unquote attention span that we can't seem to keep from them, it gets shorter and shorter. It's like they're not – I mean, I will say that for me as a child to come from a generation where my grandmother told me to sit down, collect my thoughts, sit down, gather yourself, that caused me to stop all the ripping and running or the moving and jumping I was doing and get myself together, get my thoughts together. And so when you have a generation that may have never been taught that, as well as not even having that older generation, because the generation, the parents are getting younger, the grandparents are getting younger, nobody is telling nobody anything. You're just fast with it, especially when it comes to the phones. Everything you want, is it gets there immediately, from the food you want to eat that day to the shows you want to watch. There's no wait for anything. So they're not waiting for anything. A lot of them I worked with, they're entrepreneurs coming out of high school. Everything that they know how to do, they're trying to get paid for it because they're not trying to wait. So then when I think about the detention centers and these kids, these children that are being left behind, it's like these are these same children that should be and could be out here making their money, but they don't have the right. So they get left in the wind and get called things like super predators, but y'all have not even seen their work. So I think it's great to have people like us and other people out there that are ready to sit down with them and give them the knowledge they need to go further, because they ready. They just ain't got it yet. They don't have it all the way. So to have that's it. Oh, yeah, that's what I want to. Thank y'all.
Thank you for that comment. Yes, ma'am. Thank you for calling. Assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum.
Yes, ma'am. So, Sister Sherelle, I know we had some other questions, and one of that I think kind of ties into what Sister Nyla was saying, because this concept of adultification and dehumanization of juveniles who come into the system, and the language, you know, that we talked about, how they're not treated as juveniles in the justice system, and race being a factor. You know, what do you think accounts for some of that? And, you know, of course, do you see that?
Yes. So not only are minority youth overrepresented in the juvenile justice system compared to their white peers, but they're also treated differently. Minority adolescents have a higher probability of being detained and committed than non-Hispanics and whites. African-American adolescents have the highest incarceration rates compared to all other racial populations. I have a statistic about the African-American youth that may actually surprise you. They make up 16% of all youth in the general population. They make up 30% of all juvenile court referrals, and they make up 38% of youth in residential placement, and they make up 58% of the youth admitted into state adult prison. So 58% of the youth that's in state adult prison are juveniles.
Wow. Isn't that something? Yeah, that's, and are they black too? Is that what we're saying? That's horrible. So going on, you know, because we're down to like 12 minutes, so we've you know, great conversation, lots of information. Want to ask you, Sister Sherelle, what have you learned from your research that you believe is one of the most important things you want to share with us tonight?
Yes, ma'am. The recidivism rate for arrested juveniles is relatively high, and that is 55%. Yeah. Similarly, 33% of educated minors will be re-educated within a year. 24% of minors who have been incarcerated will be re-incarcerated within a 12-month period. There are two main categories of delinquent acts. The first kind of delinquent act is one that would be deemed a crime if an adult had done it. Certain serious crimes may even be warrant that the child is tried as an adult. The second kind of delinquent act is one that wouldn't typically be a crime if an adult had done it. These are often called status offenses because they are only deemed an offense due to the individual's age. Some examples of status offense include being out past curfew, possession or consumption of alcohol or truancy or marijuana, children under the age of 14 in the absence of clear proof that at the time of committing the act charged against them, they knew its wrongfulness. Essentially, this means that a child may not be held legally responsible for an offense that they did, not knowing they were wrong when the act was committed. The female juvenile incarceration rate is rapidly increasing to the point that girls are now the fastest growing population in the juvenile justice system. Even with this uptick in female incarceration rates, the data continues to indicate that girls are less likely to be detained and committed than boys.
Wow. Yes. So, and again, so going to the youth in general, are they getting the adequate support in the community from resources and family, et cetera? What are you seeing?
Yes, no, ma'am. So youth face challenge in all areas of their life, from education and employment to finances to death, sexual health and relations. It can be the difference between getting into a university or not, getting their first job or not, meeting their rent payments or not. Action is certainly needed to ensure that young people receive timely mental health interventions. Indicators of youth mental health and well-being indicate a growing public health crisis that has only been worsened by COVID-19. In 2019, data from the National Survey on Drug Use and Health indicated that the percentage of youth ages 12 to 17 who reported experience a past year major depressive episode had doubled over the past decade. Disparities continue, and the Black and Latino children are less likely than white youth to receive treatment for their depression, including inpatient treatment, though they are no less likely to have a major depressive disorder. COVID-19 worsened these alarming trends among youth and adolescents. From March to October of 2020, CDC data indicates children's visits to the emergency room for mental health conditions increased significantly. COVID-19 also revealed ongoing disparities. Mental Health America's online screening data indicates that the youth ages 11 to 17 who identified as Native American or American Indian and those who identified as multiracial had the highest rates of depression. The largest increases in the proportion of youth experienced suicidal ideation between 2019 and 2020 were for Black and African American screeners and Hispanic or Latino screeners. Schools are critical settings for mental health policies. States have enacted policies, but the vast majority of states lack comprehensive policies in at least one category. In addition, policies are needed to effectively address youth mental health needs.
Yeah, and that's really important, sis. One of the things, too, we found as attorneys is that jails are some of the largest holders of people that suffer from mental health. So instead of getting treatment, they're just thrown in jail. And so that's something that was a real eye-opener, and racism and all the other things, problems that our people face. So, yes, ma'am, this is, this is important. And sometimes, like you say, just being a friend and having that support and having a community. Because, again, we're down to 7 minutes, Sister Sherelle. So I'm going to ask you, did you want to, go on and talk about what you'd like to share to encourage youth advocacy or empower the audience on some solutions before our time is gone? Did you want to go to that one?
Yes. Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
So
yes,
youth are not just the future, but they're also our present. Therefore, it is imperative that young people use their voice to join and create movements to have a say in their future and what may be someone else's final moments. Advocacy is often necessary for progress, and young people now have a new generational perspective on how to create a change. The young will inspire the young. Anyone can inspire another, but the youth of today that are leading the charge in advocacy will be the ones to model a life for other young people. Not only are youth inspiring other youth to get involved, but they are empowering a generation now and generations to come to make their voice heard and gather in masses for a cause to believe in. Many theories hold a key element in solving juvenile delinquency for community members to take an interest in the problem.
Adults may be able to play a vital role by displaying positive and concerned attitudes towards youth in their communities and by getting involved in the youth activities. It can be difficult to discuss issues such as drug and alcohol use, sex and crime with your child, but communication with your child is one of the most important steps in preventing juvenile delinquency. If you do not talk to your child about these issues, he or she will almost certainly learn about them from peers, television, and movies. You should make sure your child understands your rules and expectations and lay out a clear consequences for going against them. You should keep abreast of red flags and common criminal trends of modern-day teens in your area. Educate yourself on issues such as local gang symbols, popular drugs, and the symptoms of intoxication. Learn how to recognize signs of alcohol and drug use in your child so that you can immediately step in if you notice something amiss. If you cannot supervise your child after school, you should find another adult who can look after them or enroll them in some kind of extracurricular activity program. Remember that even the most responsible and brightest teens can be tempted into trouble when they are allowed to do whatever they please in the absence of adult supervision. Not only does involvement in after-school groups and extracurricular activities keep your child in a safe and supervised environment, but it can also help keep them and make them feel motivated, engaged, and accepted. Children who feel like they are a part of community and who are actively involved in an activity they are passionate about much less likely to be exposed to or tempted by criminal activity. If your child gets in trouble at home, school, or an organization or a friend's home, you should take a firm approach to punishment. By following through with the expectations and consequences you established, you help your teen understand that they can't get away with poor conduct and wrongdoing. Amidst busy work schedules, sport practices, and music lessons, you and your child likely have business schedules, which make it difficult to spend as much quality time together as you should. But try and find regular opportunities to spend time with your child. Help them with their homework, go to their sports game, go to a movie, you know, watch your favorite TV shows together. Whenever possible, sit down together as a family for dinner. During this time, you can model good behavior for your growing son or daughter while learning more about your child's interests and activities, answering questions, and helping him or her feel more comfortable with reaching out to you in times of trouble or need.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you for that. And you know, I know on your answer to question number 12 that we didn't get to, but you talked about parental and adult influence and how it's the most important factor in deterring delinquency. These are her words, you all. Coming from a young woman, you know, she even said, even if your child has committed an act of delinquency, their lives aren't over. You are the caregiver, and you have the chance to turn around their lives. I wanted to share that, Sister Rel, for you, because, again, you're just doing such an awesome job, and you have so much knowledge to share. And so we want to thank you once again for coming on the show. We're down to 2 minutes. Do we have any closing comments, Brother Deshaun?
Yes.
Yes, sir.
Well, I just wanted to say thank you, sister, because this forum is necessary, and we need to highlight our youth in the community who are doing awesome things like this, because, you know, we hear so much of the negative, and we don't always get to hear the positive. So I appreciate the work that you're doing in highlighting the work that not only that Black attorneys are doing, but highlighting the work that our youth are doing to help correct the circumstances. And Sister Sherelle, I've got a 2-year-old. I'm going to be in touch with you in a few years. I want you to get this school up and running.
That's right. Yeah, and Sister Sherelle, please forgive me for not allowing you to get to all of what you had to say, but thank you so much for sharing, and we really appreciate your time. So I would like to thank you all for listening to A Time for Justice, the Elevated Places Network. We would also like to encourage everyone to listen to Ask Dr. Ava, which is the premier show on the network. It comes on Thursdays, Clock Central Standard Time. I would like to thank the Elevated Places team. That's Sister Donna Muhammad, Brother Terrence Muhammad, Sister Rona Muhammad, And, of course, Sister Dr. Ava Muhammad. I'd also like to thank Sister Samaya Muhammad, the executive producer for our show, A Time for Justice. And we would like to invite you all to visit our website and visit the archives of the Elevated Places. And you can, you know, listen to articles and listen to archives. We want to thank you again, Sister Sherelle Muhammad, and wish you much success in your academic career and all that you aspire to, Sister. Thank you again for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. Assalamu
alaikum. Yes, ma'am. Wa alaikum salam, ma'am. Assalamu alaikum.